deed in the lives of those who worked in such dark places. With a crime of this magnitude, there would be retribution, but the Allies were unsure how to proceed. As a first step, the captured Nazi leaders had to be isolated somewhere until the Allies could sort out what to do with them.
This sequestration offered the first glimpse into the psychology of the war criminals,
and questions were immediately raised. Chapter 2. The Gathering at Ashcan. Suppose, the colonel commented, someone had written a play and put all these characters on the stage when the curtain went up. The playbill would have read, A Jail in Luxembourg in June 1945. John Kenneth Galbraith, writing about Ashcan, 1945. From Spa to Prison Camp. As the war wound down, the Nazi leaders were corralled and tucked away out of view. Nerves were raw from the sufferings of the war and the horror of the mass killings. It was prudent to hold the Nazi leaders under tight security, lest Nazi sympathizers try to free the prisoners, or Nazi victims lynch them, or lest the prisoners follow Hitler's example by killing themselves. All three were serious possibilities. The Nazi leader's holding tank could not have been more surreal. The young John Kenneth Galbraith sensed it right away, the utter improbability of the thing. It was almost a play, with villains and champions appearing scene by scene. On the champion side were Warden Burton Andrus and psychiatrist Douglas Kelly. On the other side were three of the four war criminals who are the focus of this book, Hermann Göring, Robert Ley, and Julius Streicher. Ground zero for this unlikely drama was the little village of Mondorf-les-Bains in the Grand Duchy of Luxembourg, 10 miles south of the city of Luxembourg. The luxurious Palace Hotel had been in use since mid-19th century as a spa resort. Its recent history was more complex. In the 1930s, refugees such as pianist Arthur Rubinstein fled here from the Nazis. In the early days of the war, vacationing Nazis stayed there for rest and recuperation. By 1945, U.S. troops had taken occupation and were constructing 15-foot-high barbed wire fences, watchtowers, and searchlights ringing the perimeter of the four-star resort. The Palace Hotel had now morphed into Central Continental Prisoner of War Enclosure No. 32, codenamed Ashcan. Security was so tight that getting in required a pass signed by God, and then somebody had to verify the signature. In April 1945, a contingent of German POWs, cooks, barbers, hotel managers, moved into Ashcan to prepare the building for the arrival of high-ranking Nazi detainees. The luxury furnishings were removed and replaced with military cots, and as a suicide precaution, the glass windows were replaced with screens and bars. Ashcan wasn't exactly a jail. Technically, it was a prisoner of war camp, and prisoners were free to circulate within its confines. It had somewhat the feel of an elegant old university fraternity house, but with extras, guards carrying machine guns, and the ever-present barbed wire fences and searchlights. By mid-May 1945, Ashcan was ready to welcome its many guests. I can imagine the intense curiosity the prison staff must have felt when their guests arrived at the Palace Hotel. Warden Andrus. On May 20, 1945, Colonel Burton C. Andrus was assigned as the commandant of Ashcan. He first came under fire at the age of 2 months when his father, also a West Point graduate, had taken the family to live on the Indian frontier in the 1890s. By the time Warden Andrus arrived at Mondorf-les-Bains 50 years later, he had completed an illustrious military career in the cavalry in World War I. During that war, he had developed a reputation for effective prison administration, imposing strict discipline on a previously chaotic military stockade in Georgia. At the end of World War I, he became a prison officer at the Presidio in Monterey, California. Following the war, he continued in the cavalry in a variety of postings. Continuing his service in World War II, Andrus focused on air-ground coordination, security of the New York port, and traffic regulation in Europe. To our eyes, traffic regulation evokes images of speed cameras and radar traps. Then, however, that benign-sounding office oversaw the vital movement and coordination of troops and transport on the bombed-out roads of Europe. That spring in 1945, Andrus was somewhat surprised to be summoned to the American Embassy in Paris, where General Dwight D. Eisenhower ordered him to assume command of Ashcan. On arriving at the camp, he saw security holes and immediately beefed up the perimeter with electric alarms on the fence, new and well-trained guards, camouflage netting, and more machine guns. With his previous experience in prison administration, he also focused on the conditions inside the fence. He needed doctors, adequate kitchen and sanitation facilities, and supplies, and he needed rules, clerks to type them up, and teleprinters for communication. Andrus was a very thorough man. Many of the high-ranking Nazis arrived at Ashcan with suicide on their mind. They had the examples of Hitler, Goebbels, and Himmler, and some had already attempted suicide before arriving. Hans Frank had barely survived his attempt, slashing his wrist, arm, side, and throat, while Nazi Foreign Minister Joachim von Ribbentrop was so deeply depressed that the other prisoners worried about him. As a result, Andrus ordered thorough searches of every prisoner on arrival. He found razor blades taped to the soles of men's feet and vials of cyanide and other contraband in their clothes. He confiscated scissors, neckties, suspenders, batons, and all sharp instruments, anything that could be used for self-harm. Ultimately, his efforts to block suicide were doomed to failure. Andrus made the prisoners' state of mind a chief concern. It was not that he liked them. Indeed, he regarded them with considerable distaste. Rather, to his way of thinking, suicide was an act of insubordination, rule-breaking, and he ran a tight ship. Suicide in these circumstances would also be a propaganda nightmare, suggesting a desperate response to barbaric treatment, or else a successful act of defiance. In addition to these strategic concerns about suicide, Andrus was always a professional. Wardens look after their charges and guarantee their safety until such time that they are released or executed. Thus, Andrus staffed Ashcan with morale officers. No one was going to die on his watch until he said so. Göring arrives. Reichsmarschall Hermann Göring had written to the U.S. Army on May 7, 1945, announcing his intention to surrender, and by the next night, Göring was in American custody. He surrendered under highly unusual circumstances, for Hitler had sentenced him to death for disloyalty several weeks earlier. As a result, even in American captivity, Göring feared that the SS would kill him, and strange as it may seem, for that first day, the American military allowed Göring's staff to accompany him and even keep their arms to protect him. The next day, he was flown from the small Alpine town of Kitzbühel, Austria, to Germany. It was an anxious flight because the pilot was unsure if the small two-seater plane could safely carry a man of Göring's heft. Once he got the plane off the ground, the pilot relaxed, later commenting, "Göring acted as though he was going on a sightseeing tour, and he was showing me where he grew up." When Göring landed, he expected to be treated as a head of state, and conflicts immediately ensued about his status. It was a foretaste of things to come. Göring eventually arrived at Ashcan on May 20, 1945. As Warden Andrus noted, he brought with him 16 matched monogrammed suitcases, a red hat box, and his valet. And he had a red nail polish on his fingernails and toenails. He also brought along approximately 20,000 pericodine pills, noting that he required 40 pills a day for his heart. After some discussion, Göring admitted that he used the pericodine, a morphine-like derivative, to treat his long-term morphine addiction. His addiction dated back to the 1923 Munich Putsch, when he was shot in the leg and developed chronic pain. He had been hospitalized in 1925 in Sweden and again in Germany in 1927 because of his addiction. In addition to his medical problems, Goering presented other challenges. A search for his accompanying baggage revealed a vial of cyanide buried in a tin of Nescafe and a second vial sewn into one of his uniforms. He would need to be watched. Goering had expected to be housed in a luxurious spa while details of the German demobilization were worked out. Instead, he was greeted by Warden Andrus, whom he instinctively despised. The warden, as the expression goes, loved his job. He was a bit of a martinet, and observers noted that, when he walked, he marched. He used to say, "Hell, I was 14 years old before I learned that God's last name wasn't Damn." Goering, with his taste for luxury and cynicism, had no patience for Andrus's straight-laced persona. Sparks flew immediately when Andrus and Goering met. Andrus considered Goering a simpering slob, and described him contemptuously, noting, "the blubber of high living wobbling under his jacket." Goering was the key detainee. When he arrived at Ashcan, the 5'6" Goering weighed in at 264 pounds. He was perspiring profusely, was short of breath and tremulous. He had an irregular heartbeat. He was so obese that the first chair he sat in collapsed. He gave a history of numerous heart attacks over the preceding years. This notation of heart attacks was my first indication of how difficult it would be to pin down the medical and psychiatric history of the Nuremberg war criminals. In 1945, before the widespread availability of electrocardiograms and blood tests for cardiac enzymes, heart attack could mean anything from palpitations to sudden death. In Goering's case, it probably denoted arrhythmias, no doubt worsened by anxiety and drug withdrawal. It is also possible, however, that they were panic attacks. His medical evaluation at Ashcan notes that the frequent recurrent heart attacks were manifested by pericardial distress, dyspnea, profuse perspiration, and nervousness, all of which can also be found in panic attacks. A few days after his arrival, on May 26, Goering was started on a slow reduction in his pericodine dose. He developed bronchitis on May 31, and the drug taper was suspended for a few weeks. On July 19, he complained of headaches and sleeplessness. By the end of that month, he had dropped 20 pounds, but his blood pressure was soaring. Andrus noted, "He whined and wailed as he saw one tablet less in each second handful. By 12 August, we had him completely free of the drug habit." Throughout it all, Goering continued to have heart attacks, and Andrus came under fire from his superiors, who were concerned that their prisoner might die before trial. Between Goering's increasing cardiac symptoms and pressure from his superiors, Andrus was worried. No, he didn't like Goering. He just didn't want anything to happen to him at Ashcan on his watch. So Andrus requested the addition of a physician on his staff with expertise in medicine, drug addiction, and heart disease. Army doctor Douglas Kelly seemed to fit the bill, and he was flown into Mondorf-les-Bains on August 4, 1945. His orders were cryptic. "You are to contact Captain Miller at Palace Hotel at Mondorf-les-Bains. Captain Miller will give you specific instructions as to your mission." Douglas Kelly, a most unusual psychiatrist. During the war, Douglas Kelly, M.D., was chief psychiatrist at the U.S. Army 130th General Hospital in Belgium, where he established an effective program for treating combat exhaustion. He was a decidedly unusual and eccentric man who was well respected both for his accomplishments and for his personality. It was an easy matter to transform him to Mondorf-les-Bains. Kelly was a brilliant, garrulous raconteur, able to hit it off well with all sorts of people. However, he could be glib, and he loved the spotlight, which antagonized others, particularly later during the politically sensitive war trials. Kelly had grown up in Truckee, California, a descendant of the pioneering McGlashan family, who included many lawyers and judges. He was quite literally a genius, having been part of the famous Terman study of gifted youth. He was interested in forensic psychiatry, was skeptical of scammers and malingerers, and defined mental illness narrowly. And oh, was he a talker. He had a remarkable gift of gab and could quickly assess people's strengths and vulnerabilities. Among other talents, he was also a professional magician, and after the war was even vice president of the Society of American Magicians. And did I mention that Douglas Kelly happened to be a world-renowned expert in the Rorschach? Robert Lay arrives. Two more war criminals need to be introduced before we leave Ashcan for Nuremberg. Contemporary readers may be unfamiliar with Robert Lay, but he was one of the highest-ranking Nazi leaders captured. On May 16, 1945, Lay was apprehended in his pajamas in the town of Schleching, near Berchtesgaden, where he was hiding under the name of Dr. Ernst Distelmeyer. He tried to poison himself on capture, but the bottle was knocked out of his hands. Then, when he was searched, troops discovered a cyanide capsule hidden in his ring. On his arrival at Ashcan, Lay was allowed to change from his pajamas to khakis, but even so, he looked like a Bowery bum who had got into an induction center while on a toot. In the early days of the Nazi Party, Lay had been a beer hall hooligan, but by the end of the war, he had acquired an incredibly large portfolio of responsibility. He was yet another editor of yet another anti-Semitic newspaper, but his main claim to fame was heading up the German labor front. He destroyed the independent labor unions, and their leaders, of course, built a labor force that was aligned with Nazi war plans, and helped organize slave labor to support the war effort. His closeness to Hitler shielded him from charges of arrogance and incompetence. Lay was a dreamer, with little follow-through and spotty organizational abilities, and his domain of dreams was broad, including the Volkswagen as a car for the masses, banks, travel agencies, and cruise ships dedicated to the workers, and total worker surveillance to ensure their reliability. Lay had a severe stammer that dated back to World War I when his plane was shot down. He was unconscious for hours, and when he wakened from his coma, he couldn't talk at all. Thereafter, unless he'd had a few drinks, he spoke with hesitancy. This is not an uncommon phenomenon. Perhaps it contributed to his alcoholism. With alcohol on board, his speeches were not particularly clear in terms of content, but they were effective as emotional rabble-rousing. He led a troubled life. He had a track record of embarrassing the Nazi Party because of his very public embezzlements and drunkenness. Lay quarreled constantly with other high party officials in an effort to expand his empire. Albert Speer called him a vulgar drunkard, and Alfred Rosenberg complained of Lay's organizational gigantomania. Other used saltier language, calling him a geistloser Schwarzer, mindless bullshitter. Throughout it all, Lay was unpredictable. He loved his second wife, Inga, so much that at one dinner party he tore her clothes off so that his guests could admire her body. Inga soon had had enough. Between his behavior and her drug addiction, it was too much. She shot herself in December 1942. Lay's behavior deteriorated. He became even more erratic, and his staff worried about his violent temper and out-of-control drinking. Himmler was so concerned that he asked his private physician to treat Lay. The physician soon gave up, noting that after a month he had not once found Lay sober when he made his house calls. At Ashcan, few of the other leading Nazis would have anything to do with Lay. There had been too many turf struggles with him, and his alcoholism and corruption were too much even for Goering. Lay's interrogations at Ashcan were difficult. When questioned, he would get carried away with the topic, shouting, stammering, and pacing the room. Throughout the interrogations, Lay argued that he could be useful to the Allies by organizing their working classes, just as he had done so effectively in Germany. His offers were declined. Julius Streicher arrives. 1 week after Lay arrived at Ashcan, newspaper publisher Julius Streicher, also known as Jew Baiter No. 1, was captured by American troops in Weidring, just over the Austrian border from Berchtesgaden. Stryker had been masquerading as an artist named Joseph Seiler, and was indeed painting a scene of the Alps when he was apprehended. When he arrived at Mondorf-le-Bain days later, he complained that in the interim he had been tortured by black soldiers who forced him to drink out of the urinal and burned his feet with cigarettes, all while Jews photographed him. Paradoxically, at Mondorf, Stryker claimed a change of heart toward the Jews. An American came in with a pitcher of cocoa and some biscuits. He set them on a table and stepped back. "This is from me to you, Mr. Stryker. I am a Jew." I broke down and cried. "I have always said there were no good Jews, but this has proved to me that I am wrong." The change of heart about Jews must have been transient, because Warden Andrus wrote, "He was so obsessed with hatred that when he mentioned the word Jew, he trembled visibly." Other staff at Ashcan noted how Stryker bragged about his accomplishments and would start ranting volubly, carried away by excitement. He felt that other Nazis had cheated him out of getting credit for inspiring the Nuremberg Laws. Stryker was a tactless, uncouth man, whom the other internees detested. He was obsessed with sex, bragging that if people wanted to see how strong he was, they should make a woman available to him in prison. At one point, when he was asked to undress for a physical examination, the female interpreter started to leave the room. Stryker leered at her and said, "What's the matter? Are you afraid of seeing something nice?" This was not a man who cared about making a good impression. Tact had never been Stryker's strong suit. During the war, he gossiped that Goering was not man enough to have a child, and that Goering's daughter, Etta, must have been a product of artificial insemination. What's worse, he published the rumor in Der Stürmer. Goering had him arraigned in front of the Nazi Party Arbitration and Investigation Committee. The Nazi judge presiding over the trial stated, "We were ready to stop that sick mind once and for all." Because of this accusation, and his many shady business transactions, in 1940, Stryker was confined to house arrest on his farm for the rest of the war. Life at Ashcan. The status of the detainees was uncertain. Were they in protective custody, war criminals, prisoners of war? They had not been indicted or charged with any crimes. Rather, they were being held as POWs, and thus had less restricted activities than they would in a formal prison. In Ashcan, the detainees regarded their sequestration as temporary until the terms of the Allied victory could be nailed down. In the months of their detention, intelligence officers frequently interrogated them, but the detainees had plenty of time to pace on the long veranda, to think, and to gossip. Despite its somewhat Spartan furnishings, the prison resembled a retreat center. A famous photograph captures the detainees in a posed moment as the class of 1945 in front of the hotel. The detainees were eager to talk. They were bored, worried, and accustomed to being in the center of things. They felt neglected if they hadn't been interrogated by someone for several days. If you were interrogated a lot, it meant you were important. Some talked out of guilt, but as John Dolebois, the Ashcan intelligence officer, put it, their favorite pastime was casting blame. These comments help us understand the detainees' unusual openness to psychiatric interviews and psychological examinations. Goering constantly chafed against the rules and regarded Andrus as a petty tyrant. He called him that pompous fireman because of Andrus's proclivity to tour the camp wearing his highly polished red helmet. Andrus was fit to be tied. "They are perverts, dope fiends, and liars. When Dr. Frank got here, he was wearing a pair of lace panties. Goering brought an apple-cheeked valet with him. When Lay got here, he had a gonorrheal stricture and complained that he couldn't live without women. When Wehrmacht Commander Wilhelm Keitel got here, we took his baton away from him, and he went all to pieces and wrote a letter to Eisenhower. These are the eagles who planned and executed World War." From the distance, the detainees were all high-ranking Nazis, and it could be assumed that they saw things similarly. In reality, they were a disparate lot. Generals, cabinet members, industrialists, propagandists. Many held long-time grudges against one another. Goering insisted that he was the senior commander of the internees, but Admiral Karl Dönitz, not Goering, was Hitler's named successor. Wilhelm Frick, Reich Minister of the Interior, complained that Goering treated him like a little boy. Stryker complained that Goebbels had cheated him out of receiving credit for the Nuremberg race laws. Goering complained that Goebbels and Ribbentrop turned Hitler against him. Almost all of the other Nazis shunned Stryker. Dönitz and several others immediately moved their chairs and refused point blank to sit with him because they regarded him as a sadist, rapist, and loathsome pornographer. Stryker's only friend at Mondorf was Ley, and they were known as the Bobbsey twins, not just because they sat together, but also because they resembled each other physically. Through it all, Stryker paced with the rest of them on the hotel veranda, but he alone would stand at attention, salute, and shout, "Heil Hitler!" Ashcan is emptied. After roughly 3 months, Ashcan was closed on August 12, 1945, and the building reverted to the Palace Hotel. The detainees, as well as Warden Andrus and psychiatrist Kelly, were transferred to Nuremberg. There they were joined by the detainee Rudolf Hess, psychologist Gustav Gilbert, and prosecutor Justice Robert Jackson. We will make their acquaintance in Chapter 4. A brief interlude, however, is necessary in order to consider how a war crimes trial came about in the first place, and why in Nuremberg. What became of Ashcan? In 1988, the Palace Hotel was torn down, and a new hotel, Mondorf Domain Thermal, occupies the site today. As a contemporary guidebook describes it, the health resort is known for its idyllic location, with vineyards and woods to the east, and the Lorraine Hills to the west. Not a word about Ashcan. Part 2. Nuremberg. Chapter 3. The Nuremberg War Crimes Trial. What do we do with the criminals? The trial can hold up a mirror to Germany and help her to solve her own perplexing mystery. That mystery which, in Nuremberg and the countryside around it, is set out in flowers. It is difficult not to conclude that a people who so love flowers must love all beautiful and simple things. The landscape continues this protestation of innocence, this artless seduction. Where the pine trees rise from the soft reddish bed of scented pine needles, and the miller's little blonde son plays with a gray kitten among the meadow sweet by the end of the mill pond, there can surely be no harm. There is, of course, evidence to the contrary. Rebecca West, Extraordinary Exile, September 7, 1946. The wrongs which we seek to condemn and punish have been so calculated, so malignant, and so devastating that civilization cannot tolerate their being ignored because it cannot survive their being repeated. That four great nations, flushed with victory and stung with injury, stay the hand of vengeance and voluntarily submit their captive enemies to the judgment of the law is one of the most significant tributes that power has ever paid to reason. Justice Robert Jackson, Opening Address, International Military Tribunal, November 21, 1945. The Purpose of the Trial. While the guests at Ashcan were walking the veranda of the Palace Hotel that long summer, the Allies were hammering out the details of what would develop into the International Military Tribunal. The conversations had been ongoing since 1943, but kept breaking down. What should be done with the captured leaders of the Third Reich? History provided no rules for what to do with defeated wartime leaders. Napoleon Bonaparte was exiled and imprisoned on the island of Elba, and Kaiser Wilhelm II abdicated and spent his remaining years in exile after World War I. Such leniency rankled, particularly in the shadow of the concentration camps. It was no surprise then that the Allies disagreed about having a trial at all. The Russians saw no need for one and favored quick executions in a back alley. At the Tehran conference in 1943, Joseph Stalin proposed executing between 50,000 and 100,000 German military officers. Winston Churchill was so incensed by the suggestion that he threatened to walk out, and Franklin D. Roosevelt broke the tension by joking that perhaps only 49,000 would need to be shot. The three leaders' positions on these points waffled as the war wound down. At a subsequent meeting, Churchill proposed that the Nazi leaders be summarily shot, but Stalin, of all people, replied, "In the Soviet Union, we never execute anyone without a trial." Some Americans thought that selective trials were a waste of time and that it would make more sense to execute lots of Germans. Joseph Pulitzer thought that 1.5 million was about the right number. Over time, though, U.S. leaders decided that a public trial was necessary, not only to punish the Nazi leaders, but also to unmask their brutality. Ultimately, the International Military Tribunal was created. The Third Reich had destroyed any notion that justice could be found in the German court system, and the international trials were designed to demonstrate that law and justice had returned to Germany. All the same, the attitude of the Russians throughout the trials was more or less accurately characterized as, "Can we kill them now?" Early in the proceedings, there was a formal reception for court personnel, and Andrei Vyshinsky, Stalin's prosecutor for the purge trials, proposed a toast, "To the prisoners and their march from the Palace of Justice to the gallows." The trial hadn't even started yet. Were the judges supposed to raise their glasses to such a toast? Russian legal scholar Aron Trinan opined, "In meting out punishment to the Axis war criminals, Russia would not permit herself to be restricted by traditional legalisms." Even after agreeing to a trial, the Allies were uncertain about its wisdom. Would it not appear to be merely another show trial? Wasn't this just an instance of victor's justice? Given the Russians' role in the mass murders in Poland and Ukraine, would the Allies be viewed as hypocrites in their judgment and revenge against the Nazi defendants? It would take the Allies all summer long in 1945 to thrash out these details. Not least among their disputes was the venue for the trial. The disagreements among the Allies foreshadowed the corrosive conflicts that came to dominate Nuremberg. So much horror was revealed that its caustic effects spilled over onto everyone in attendance. The lawyers, judges, guards, interpreters, witnesses, and certainly prison psychiatrists and psychologists. Those emotional reverberations would come to haunt the psychiatric assessment of the prisoners. There is a term for it, countertransference, which needs some explanation. I teach medical students and have heard a recurring lament over the years. "Why is it that I am so exhausted when I am on my psychiatry clerkship? I don't get it. The call schedule is light and the patients aren't dying, but after listening all day, I leave the ward feeling like I could scream." When you sit with a patient, you cannot help having an emotional response to what the patient discloses. Novice therapists are sometimes taken aback by these emotional reverberations, and they don't know how to deal with them. Over the years, I've treated thousands of patients. But even if I had seen 10 times that many patients, had I been assigned to Nuremberg, I don't think my clinical experience would have prepared me for encountering the horror so close up. Nuremberg, site for the International Military Tribunal. All this monstrosity was unveiled in a place previously famed for its beauty and culture. Nuremberg had a centuries-long reputation for toy making. Lovely porcelain dolls, artfully constructed wooden toys, tin models, absolutely captivating toy trains and steam engines. The Nazi Party changed all that. Stormtroopers rallied in vast plazas and amphitheaters. Thudding boots, hoarsely shouted oaths, waving torches, and banners of black and red and white pushed the toys aside. When the Reichstag convened there in 1935 to pass the Nuremberg racial laws, the city was already home to scurrilous Nazi propaganda newspapers. It would soon have a large armaments industry dependent on slave labor and its very own concentration camp, Flossenbürg. The toys were gone. In their place came war, and by the war's end, Nuremberg was no more. Repeated bombing sorties had destroyed over 90% of the buildings. An estimated 30,000 bodies rotted in the ruins. The place stunk with death and gloom. Nuremberg had disappeared into the night and fog. Ironically, the Nuremberg Palace of Justice survived relatively unscathed and became ground zero for the trial of the major war criminals before the International Military Tribunal. Conveniently adjacent to the Nuremberg courthouse, a large prison had also survived the bombings. The extensive destruction surrounding these buildings provided a natural security perimeter for the trial. In addition to these concrete advantages, Nuremberg was the symbolic center of Nazi Germany. If one were to go to the belly of the beast of Nazi Germany for a trial, there would be few venues better than Nuremberg. It was thus both a pragmatic and deeply symbolic venue for the trial. But what kind of trial? The Legal Team, Quarrels and Grudges. Supreme Court Justice Robert Jackson was chosen as the lead American prosecutor. Jackson grew up in rural New York. He never attended college, and his legal training consisted of 1 year at Albany Law School, followed by a legal apprenticeship. His law practice flourished, and he became noted for his eloquence. He began his federal service in 1934. And worked his way up from General Counsel of the Bureau of International Revenue to Assistant Attorney General, Solicitor General, and Attorney General. In 1941, he was appointed an Associate Justice of the United States Supreme Court. President Roosevelt died on April 12, 1945. By coincidence, the next day, Jackson was scheduled to give a lecture on the rule of law among nations. He told his audience that although he had no objections to summary executions, he worried that they would make martyrs of the Nazi leaders if executions were used in place of a trial. As to having a trial, he spoke about his concerns regarding jurisdiction and application of international laws, by which standards of guilt may be determined. He concluded with this telling observation: "You must put no man on trial before anything that is called a court, if you are not willing to see him freed, if not proven guilty." There were ears in that audience. 2 weeks later, President Harry Truman asked Jackson to take a leave of absence from the Supreme Court and to lead the U.S. prosecution. In the next month, there were so many squabbles within the government and in the press concerning the mission of the tribunal that Jackson threatened to resign if the hardliners tried to undercut the legal proceedings. The newspapers called him soft on Germany. Still, Jackson prevailed, assembled his team, moved to Europe, and began to amass the evidence. On June 7, 1945, he published his persuasive justification for the war crimes trial. "What shall we do with them? We could, of course, set them at large without a hearing, but it has cost unmeasured thousands of American lives to beat and bind these men. To free them without a trial would mock the dead and make cynics of the living. On the other hand, we could execute or otherwise punish them without a hearing. But undiscriminating executions or punishments without definite findings of guilt fairly arrived at would not set easily on the American conscience. The only other course is to determine the innocence or guilt of the accused after a hearing as dispassionate as the times and horrors we deal with will permit. We are put under a heavy responsibility to see that our behavior during this unsettled period will direct the world's thought toward a firmer enforcement of the laws of international conduct, so as to make war less attractive to those who have governments and the destinies of peoples in their power." Jackson spent the summer of 1945 gathering evidence and negotiating the procedures that would be used for the trial. Agreement among the Allies was difficult because of emerging Cold War rivalries and divergent legal traditions. At one point in the discussions about the structure of the emerging trial, Russian Major General Iona Nikitchenko turned to Jackson, asking, "What is meant in the English by cross-examine?" it was just a foretaste. Nuremberg was just the first of hundreds of war crimes trials that ultimately prosecuted thousands of defendants. Hitler, Goebbels, and Himmler had all killed themselves earlier. Others had gone missing. At Nuremberg, the Allies prosecuted the highest-ranking Nazi leaders they could find, leaders who ran the economy, the military, and the propaganda apparatus. Here was the opportunity for the world to see them up close, to hear them, to try to understand what made them tick. The trial involved approximately 1,500 interpreters, lawyers, interrogators, jailers, and others who were closely monitored by hundreds of journalists, including Rebecca West, Walter Lippmann, and John Dos Passos, as well as visiting movie stars like Rita Hayworth and Marlene Dietrich. Not surprisingly, orchestrating this was a nightmare. I've been in courtrooms before and know their rituals of who sits where and who speaks when. I have seen how each side tries to spin its version of the truth and have sat through hours of tedious testimony. I can't imagine what it would have been like to sit in that courtroom for a 10-month trial. The reports are clear that at Nuremberg there were long intervals of monotony, punctuated by horrifying testimony and frankly odd behaviors on many people's part, no matter where they sat in the courtroom. There was discord among the judges and prosecuting attorneys. Justice Robert Jackson had voluntarily stepped down from the Supreme Court to be the lead prosecutor. It rankled him to have his pleadings decided on by judges like Francis Biddle, whom he regarded as his junior. Biddle in turn scorned Jackson, writing, "Jackson's cross-examination on the whole has been futile and weak. Bob doesn't listen to the answers, depends on his notes, always a sign of weakness. He hasn't absorbed his case." Most observers agreed that Jackson was indeed rusty on his cross-examination skills, but enormously eloquent in his prepared statements. His closing statement, for instance, replete with allusions to Shakespeare, still rings loudly today. "The accused stand before this trial as blood-stained Gloucester stood by the body of his slain king. He begged of the widow as they beg of you, 'Say I slew them not.' And the queen replied, 'Then say they were not slain, but dead they are.' If you were to say of these men that they are not guilty, it would be as true to say that there has been no war, there are no slain, there has been no crime." Despite his gift for eloquence, Jackson believed that the case would be made on the basis of an abundance of captured Third Reich documents. From Jackson's point of view, documents had advantages over witnesses. Witnesses could be problematic, there might be difficulties locating them, their memories could be hazy, and their motivations impugned. But documents were there in black and white. At Nuremberg, the amount of documentary evidence was breathtaking. It filled 6 boxcars and sprawled over millions of pages, including 100,000 affidavits and potential testimony from more than 35,000 witnesses. Jackson was correct, but others noted that the trial was important beyond simply convicting the defendants. General William Donovan, head of the Office of Strategic Services, believed that live testimony was crucial if the trial were to have an impact on the German people and the rest of the world. Without riveting testimony, it was unlikely that the trial would garner attention. Donovan volunteered to assist Jackson with the prosecution, but sadly their blurred reporting lines and responsibilities fostered distrust. Donovan was also keenly aware of the rapidly fraying alliance between the Soviet Union and the West. In his view, it was vital for the West to secure an alliance with their former German enemies against the Russians, and for the West to acquire the remnants of the Nazis' military capabilities. Although these matters would become very important in the Cold War years, they were irrelevant to Jackson. Their disagreements became personal. Jackson considered Donovan a shallow social climber who was trying to smear him. Donovan thought that Jackson was naive about the larger picture of foreign relations and world opinion. Such conflicts percolated down to their legal staffs. Who was more important, the document sleuths or the interrogators? The international competition was both intense and petty. Thomas Dodd, one of the American prosecutors, painted a vivid description of the rivalries in his letters home. There is terrific jockeying for position. Everyone wants to be in the act. A lot of little people in big uniforms frantically seeking a place in the sun. The bickering was ever present. The whiff of fame turned many a level head. On the first day of trial, there was a quarrel among the judges over whose chair was higher or lower. Even at the end, on the day of execution, the pettiness continued. When the court's judgments were read on October 1, 1946, Jackson refused the military's request to sit as official observers with the prosecutor's team. The generals got their revenge weeks later. Remembering Jackson's slight, the military retaliated by refusing to admit one of Jackson's staff members as a witness to the execution. Even after months of negotiating procedures for the trial, there were conflicting interpretations of jurisprudence among the Allies. The Russians' behavior was troublesome. The Russian Nikitchenko switched jobs in midstream from prosecutor to judge and had different ideas about judicial impartiality. He saw no need for a lengthy trial, just to create a sort of fiction that the judge is a disinterested person that would lead only to delays. As a spokesman for Stalin, he believed in speedy trials. The course of the trial. Warden Burton Andrus fretted about the prisoners' security. He complained bitterly that there were not enough guards, that their training was inadequate and morale was low. At Ashcan, he had worried about a jail breakout or else vigilantes breaking in. At Nuremberg, other problems preoccupied him. His concerns would be borne out. Suicide was a constant threat. Andrus was hardly a fan of psychiatry and psychology, but he rather liked the blunt-talking Kelly, and despite initial reluctance, followed many of Kelly's recommendations for maintaining the prisoners' morale. Simultaneously, Andrus imposed strict security on the prison. Prisoners and their cells were repeatedly searched, access was tightly controlled, and guards observed all prisoners one-on-one for 24 hours a day. The desks and chairs in the cells were flimsily constructed so that they could not be used for harm. It didn't work. Dr. Leonardo Conti managed to hang himself on October 5, 1945. Conti had been the SS chief of health, and his specialty was mercy killing. He was being held at Nuremberg for a later trial, but he escaped through suicide. It wasn't the last suicide at Nuremberg either. There would be two more, each more spectacular than the last, and Andrus's reputation sank lower with each suicide. He kept tightening security, drilling his staff, and enforcing such harsh discipline on the prisoners that he came to haunt the prisoners in their dreams. Eight of the defendants told their attorneys that they had recurrent nightmares about the warden. There were other problems, scuffles and bickering among the prisoners. Stryker spat on Hans Fritsch of the propaganda ministry. SS General Ernst Kaltenbrunner had a stroke. This was not going to be an easy assignment for Andrus. On October 19, 1945, Warden Andrus delivered the indictments to the prisoners. They were asked to write down their responses. Hermann Göring inscribed, "The victor will always be the judge, and the vanquished the accused." Rudolf Hess wrote, "I can't remember." When offered a list of possible lawyers, Julius Streicher said, "Jews. These are all Jew names, and I know the judges are Jews too." Robert Lay, holding his arms out like Christ on the cross, greeted the group by shouting, "Why don't you just line us up against a wall and shoot us?" At last, the trial began, on November 20, 1945. After all of the testimony, the prosecution summarized the case beginning on July 26, 1946, and the tribunal adjourned for deliberation. Their judgment was delivered on October 1, 1946. 2 weeks later, the sentences were carried out. The defendant's behavior during the trial. The trial presented an unusual opportunity for psychological observations in the courtroom, in the jail dining room, and in the prisoners' cells. Some of the defendant's behavior was apparent to all. Some was revealed only during psychiatric interviews. It was immediately apparent that the defendants were extraordinarily heterogeneous. Some were very high-ranking, others were indicted almost by accident as prisoners of convenience. Whatever their rank in the Nazi hierarchy, many of them loathed each other. Joachim von Ribbentrop and Hermann Göring continually sparred. On one occasion, Göring tried to strike Ribbentrop with his marshal's baton, shouting, "Shut up, you champagne peddler," while Ribbentrop retorted, "I am still foreign minister, and my name is von Ribbentrop," thereby asserting his nobility. Under the mounting pressures of the trial, the animosities increased. Göring called witnesses for the prosecution swine, and Stryker cackled gleefully that they would all hang, even people like Albert Speer, former Minister of Armaments and War Production, who had cooperated with the prosecution. The defendants were in agreement about one thing: Foreign Minister von Ribbentrop's incompetence. Baldur von Schirach, head of the Hitler Youth and Gauleiter, district leader, of Vienna, was delighted to see Ribbentrop revealed as a phony. Hjalmar Schacht, Minister of Economics and Reichsbank President, called him a scatterbrained idiot, and Franz von Papen, Hitler's vice-chancellor, referred to him as a nitwit. As the Nuremberg interrogator Joseph Meyer succinctly summed up, "What a motley crew." Most of the defendants shifted blame elsewhere, principally to the dead Hitler and Himmler, who could no longer retaliate against them. 10 months of testimony had repeating themes. It was terrible that all these things happened, but we didn't know, or if we did know, we didn't know the extent of the killing, or if we opposed the killings, Hitler would have ordered us shot, or all we did was fill out the forms. Defendant Fritz Sauckel's response is typical. "I just can't get it through my head how these things were possible, about the misuse of foreign workers. I am really not responsible for that. I was like a Siemens agency. If I supply hands for a ship, I am not responsible for any cruelty that may be exercised about ship without my knowledge. I just supplied workers to places like the Krupp works at Hitler's orders. I am not to blame if they were later mistreated." Göring would have none of that. He viewed such arguments as craven and undignified excuses. It was tantamount to selling your soul to the enemy, and he was determined to dominate the trial and his fellow defendants. Prosecutor Dodd observed, "He is browbeating and threatening them, and particularly those who might admit some guilt. He wants all to hang together, and to prove that Roosevelt was the cause of the war." After hearing a particularly damning witness for the prosecution, Göring shouted to his fellow defendants, "Damn it, I just wish we could all have the courage to confine our defense to 3 simple words, lick my arse." Göring, who fancied himself the leader of the defendants, told Kelly, "We are sort of like a team, all of us who have been accused, and it is up to us to stick together to accomplish the strongest defense. Naturally, I am the leader, so it is my problem to see that each of us contributes his share." In the early days of the trial, Göring cracked the whip at lunchtime if he saw anyone wavering. He didn't want any dissension, plea deals, shifting of blame, or acknowledgement of guilt. Speer tattled on him, and Andrus promptly changed the lunch hour regulations. Strange things pop up in archives. "I was working at the National Archives in College Park, Maryland, when I stumbled upon the warden's seating chart for lunch. There it was, a map of the tables with seating assignments for each table. You would think this was a formal dinner party, but what was really being served was Göring's isolation from the other defendants. He sat alone. In the prisoner's dock, that isolation was impossible, with Göring in the front row whispering and commenting sotto voce throughout the trial." During the trial, Hess pretended to be bored and uninterested by ostentatiously reading novels or else moaning in pain. He would pose enormous challenges not just for the judges, but also for his defense attorneys. Stryker was absolutely impossible, antagonizing any sentient being within earshot. There is an old saying, "The tongue is enemy to the neck." This proved quite